The Bitchery of History is brought to you by Audible.com.
You can start your free trial and get a free audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Hello.
Hi, everyone.
And welcome to week 36. Of
the Bitchery of History.
My name is Max.
I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm going to be talking to you about Wang Songar.
Whoa.
Yeah, honey.
I am going to be talking about Ima Sumac.
Ooh.
Get excited. Another one that shout out to Olivia Mowry sent me.
Love,
and
Olivia.
It was a Google doodle. So also shout out to Google for always doing awesome women. So I'm going to start out, actually, I think, by playing you this little music, this little song here.
Note.
That is entirely one person singing.
That was amazing.
That's her vocal range. It spanned
That whole thing was her?
Five octaves.
Jesus.
That entire thing was her. So for a time she was termed the eighth wonder of the world because that's essentially unparalleled to have a 5-octave vocal range.
The only other person I can think of is Frankie Valli, and there's a whole musical about him. It's the only reason I know about it.
Right?
Where's her musical?
Well, I guess we gotta make one.
Let's do it.
We gotta get it together. Ima Sumac is a Peruvian singer. She was born in Peru in a little tiny mountain town, mountain village. Mm-hmm. And she was actually one of the descendants of Peru's last Incan emperor.
Oh.
It is claimed. Royal blood. Mm-hmm. Of course. So she was born on September 13th, 1922. There's sometimes some debate about what the exact date is, but that seems to be the most official one.
Okay.
Her birth name was Zoila Augusta Emperatriz Chavarri del Castillo.
Love.
She wanted to become a singer, but a lot of people in Peru were like, that's not really proper for a lady to be a singer, so don't do it. So what she would do is she would climb up high in the Andes Mountains and sing to all the rocks that she pretended were her audience.
Oh, I love that.
And that's where she started hearing birds and then began imitating the birds, which is why she's got this crazy, or could be one of the reasons she's got this crazy vocal range. By the time she was 13, her voice had begun to really mature and really grow, and she was invited to do some singing on the radio, even though her parents were not happy about that. She would then record a lot of songs in Argentina. She met a conductor who they later married, but they then formed a little trio with a dancer, and they traveled around kind of South America, Peru. They were very well known, but of course, this being, well, any time, really.
Early 20th century.
But early 20th century, of course, they wanted to go to America and go to New York and travel the world.
Land of opportunity.
So they did move to New York. They continued performing. They weren't a huge hit right away because a lot of the songs that they performed were folk music and Peruvian folk music, which was in 1940s, 1950s was a little bit like, hey, I don't get this.
The music du jour.
Not the cup of tea.
Yeah.
However, there were some who were really enchanted mm-hmm. with them, and especially with her face and her voice. Mm. I mean, her voice is incredible.
Yeah. This is the 20s. It would be the jazz age, yeah?
So there's gotta be it's in more in the 40s, 43. Oh, okay. But still, right. I mean, still kind of jazzy. One night she was singing in a New York club and a talent scout from Capitol Records happened to be mm-hmm. present.
Okay.
So he immediately signed her.
Because he could see what was there. Because
it's a no-brainer. Right. It's a no-brainer. He had her change her name to Emma Sumac.
Okay.
Which she had been spelling I-M-M-A-S-U-M-A-C-K. And he said, no, let's spell it Y-M-A-S-U-M-A-C because that looks really exotic and fancy. So that's the only reason it's spelled that way. And it's pronounced exactly the way it looks, so it's not tricky.
If we had a list of the things that Hollywood just did because they...
Right. He also did away a little bit with the traditional Peruvian accompaniment to her voice and said, no, we need a full orchestra behind you. We're going to need to have all of these things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, 40s, 50s, big band.
Right.
Love.
Right. Emma was now in her mid-20s, and that is when her voice reached its peak. Again, completely unparalleled, this 5-octave range. She recorded a record called Voice of the Xtabe in 1950, which sold over 100,000 copies with no major publicity.
Wow.
Essentially just word of
mouth.
On
the merits of itself,
being like, bro, you gotta listen to this chick.
We call that organic.
Right.
Organic marketing.
So she then had a hugely successful concert at the Hollywood Bowl, also in 1950, and that is what kind of launched her into being world famous. Mm. And she soon started traveling the world and became just really a total phenomenon. I mean, I have never heard anything like that.
No. Especially from where she came from.
Right. So Sumac and her husband remained pretty true to their roots, often singing in Spanish or in the Peruvian language of Quichuan. In 1961, Emma was going to go and do just 2 weeks of concerts in Russia. Uh-huh. You know, not really a big deal. But they so fell in love with her in Russia, she ended up being there for 6 months.
Oh my god. They like gave her a Vegas residency.
Right? They were just like, listen, you keep selling out and why don't you stay forever?
I bet that was a very I can do right? that.
In the early 1970s, she completed a full album of psychedelic music titled Miracles. However, she had kind of a temper and mm-hmm. that a little bit took over the album. It got then pulled from the shelves, so it's very rare to find a copy of this album. You can find it on eBay sometimes, but it's like collector's memorabilia status. In the 1980s, her career was rejuvenated because young people all over the world just kind of started to find this music and go, again, oh my god.
Right.
Oh my god, listen to this woman. This is ridiculous. Also, in the mid-90s, one of her songs was used in the Coen Brothers movie, The Big Lebowski. Which brought another huge, what is this song? Who is singing? What is this? She was then given the Orden del Sol of Peru in May of 2006. She traveled to Peru to accept this honor and stayed about 2 weeks accepting other awards like almost daily because everyone was going, oh my gosh, here, take this prize.
Take it.
What is surprising and amazing is she only ever made 5 albums and she's this world class phenomenon traveler called the 8th wonder of the world for her range by some people.
This is like the moment when you, at the moment, at when the end, you're like, she's 23.
Yeah, only 5 albums.
Only 5 albums.
Beyonce level status, but just, no, I'm only going to do 5.
For real Beyonce level status.
Like, I'm not into it.
Or even Adele. She's only got 3.
Right? Her albums have been continually reissued for, you know, all the 50 years that they have been out.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, newer generations find out about her and go,
listen, when something's good, it's good.
Oh my god.
Right, yeah. Stands the test of time.
Right. She passed away on November 1st, 2008 in Los Angeles. And she's actually buried in the Hollywood Forever Cemetery.
Oh, wow. Right by where I live.
Yeah. So we could go check out her gravesite sometime.
Mm, absolutely. I'd like to do that.
But I really like that story because at first when I was reading about it, I thought, this is just cool. Mm-hmm. Talk about another South American woman. Everybody has these hidden talents. But then when I started reading it, I was blown away. But even more, a lot of times people are like, oh, listen to this cool old song. It's great. And I'm kind of like, I really don't like jazz. Mm-hmm. So I was preparing mentally to roll my eyes and just like turn it off. Uh-huh. And then it cuts into that like operatic high note thing out of nowhere. And my jaw was on the floor. I'll listen to this forever. I don't care.
Do you think when they were choosing her name, the sumac part of it? Because sumac is a poison, or like a large part of the sumac plant species is poisonous. Hmm. That's where poison ivy is. It's part of the sumac, poison sumac. I wonder if that's something that like helped her allure, like, ooh, sumac.
A little bit dangerous and seductive.
A little seductive.
But you know what it also makes me think of, and this didn't occur to me until I was recounting the story out loud, is the film and the life of Edith Piaf, La Vie en Rose.
Oh,
because also
yeah.
just like singing in the street, singing to the Stones. Somebody make a movie about this, please.
Yeah, seriously.
Somebody's just going to have to lip sync to the songs, though, because I don't think you're going to find anybody that can sing that.
No. You're going to have like, multiple people dub different parts of the octave. Yeah.
Yep.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that.
Of course.
Let's talk about from rags to riches.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
All right. So, Wang Songer was born around 1777 China.
Okay.
She lives during the Qing Dynasty, which is the last great dynasty of China. Mm-hmm. It was taken down eventually by the People's Revolution and Mao Zedong.
Ooh.
So she...
For real, the last one.
For real, the last one. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
She was born to a single mother. Her father died when she was 3. So, I mean, she was born to 2 parents, but her father died before. And they essentially had to resort to begging to live. Her mother was a washerwoman. She would hire herself out as a domestic servant. Both her and Wang, I mean, by the time Wang was 8, she was already begging on the streets.
Oh.
And then by the time she turns 13, she, in order to escape the abject poverty, she joins this traveling circus troupe where she learns...
That's not where I thought this was going.
So in China, martial arts and acrobatics, it's mm-hmm. considered the pinnacle of warfare. But at the same time, it's also considered the pinnacle of human achievement, like what you can do physically.
Have you seen Cirque du Soleil?
Right. I mean, look at the Olympics.
I'm on board.
Right?
I'm on board.
So she joins this traveling circus troupe and they go around doing tricks and acrobats and all this kind of stuff for money to say, you know, to survive.
Right.
And she ends up, during this time, also learning Kung Fu, which
yes.
basically forms the basis of every single other Asian martial art.
Right.
To some extent.
Right.
And she becomes a master. She becomes known as a master in Kung Fu.
Okay.
And China has a very long tradition of accepting women as warriors, accepting women as people in power.
Just look back at Qing Shi.
Right?
And Ping Yang.
Exactly, right?
On board.
So I got this quote. This is actually a quote to write to that point. I was watching this documentary called Warrior Women, which is the same thing that I watched for Joan of Arc and for Lozen.
Right.
And there's this woman, they're talking about Kung Fu and all that stuff, right? And she says, if a woman can take up weapons, stand tall, and fend off the enemy, she will overcome any obstacle in her way. A woman of action, with the resilience of steel, who is bold enough, triumph in adversity is rare. That is something most men fail to achieve. That is why we say the heroic deeds of a woman are more worthy of our admiration and respect than those of a man. And this is a Chinese woman talking about Chinese culture and how they view it. And in fact, by the time Wang comes around, there are about 40 well-documented female warriors, leaders throughout Chinese history. So like, this is all to go towards when we get to the part in her story, which is like her big part, you can really understand why these people just respected her so much, right? So she's living on the streets. The streets are very dangerous at this time. She's attacked constantly, but she's a kung fu master. So it's not like she's can't defend herself.
Mm-hmm.
Until one day, around 16, she's walking through the city and she gets jumped by about 6 men all at once.
Oh, no.
And despite her amazing kung fu skills, she's not able to overcome them. But at the last second, she's saved by a Chinese official, actually, named Qi Lin.
Okay.
And he helps her fight them all off. And he afterwards invites her. He sees her skills. He sees how she fights. And he invites her to join the secret society that he leads.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
This man is a double agent. He works for the government.
I'm already so excited.
But he also...
This is the best thing ever. Okay, go on.
But he is the leader of this sect of a group called the White Lotus, which also finds itself, if you watch Avatar...
Oh, this is...
Avatar: The Last Airbender is... The White Lotus is a real society which has existed for centuries in China. It has lasted through many incarnations. And at the time that Qi Lin comes around, it's a Buddhist sect. In fact, it had always been a Buddhist sect. And they believed that in order for the Buddha to come again and to redeem everyone on Earth, they had to overthrow the government. Because until that happened, because the government wasn't Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
So until that happened, the Buddha wouldn't come. Now, not only does she know Kung Fu, but now she learns sword fighting. She learns how to fight with a sword in both hands, which is something that is very difficult to do. And so she joins this sect of the White Lotus, and she rises very quickly.
Duh.
Because again, she's a Kung Fu master already. The White Lotus sect is made up of... It's, you have to know at this point, the Qing dynasty really doesn't care about the people.
I
mean, they're living in like abject poverty, they're raising taxes,
Oy.
They're living in this feudal system where the feudal lords were allowed to raise rent on the lands astronomically. And then the people would borrow money at very high interest rates. And then when they couldn't pay it, they'd get kicked off the land and the process would start all over again. You really had no middle class. It was low and upper, and that was it, right? With all the upper people taking advantage of all the lower people. And so the White Lotus and all of these revolutionary forces were made up of peasants using farm tools, essentially. It's a peasants' revolt, revolution, made up of women and men, both. And so she rises quickly. And she also falls in love with Qi Lin during this time as well.
Duh.
And they get married.
Oy.
And after they get married, he's referred to as master and she's referred to as second master. So they're both the masters of this only because he was...
I guess that's better than being master and mistress or something.
Right. Yeah.
But still... That was a very audible eye roll, listeners.
I think it's also because of the way that their society works.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I don't think it's...
However, I will say, just speaking of society, and obviously society in China is very different today
absolutely.
Than it was in the 1700s, but I've always been, like, had zero interest in traveling anywhere in China or Japan or, like, anywhere in Asia. It just doesn't hold any appeal to me.
Sure, that's fair.
But this, like, and then hearing, like, oh no, women are dope, and we've always known that, and we just think that they should always be kick-ass leaders. I'm like, you know what? China sounded pretty good. Pretty much like a place I want to go visit.
Yeah. They've got problems, but they've got a lot of good, too. They've got a lot of good.
I'm excited.
So in 1795, she's 18 years old. Her sect of the White Lotus, they plan a rebellion. It's New Year's Eve on 1795. And they are in this big city, and they are going to take it over. They're going to start a revolt, start a revolution, and their goal eventually is to topple the Qing dynasty. Unfortunately, one of their sect members sold them out for 2 silver ingots.
Only two
silver ingots. The plan is foiled. More than 100 members of their sect are executed, including Qi Lin.
Oh my god.
So she loses her husband.
Oh.
So understandably, she is very sad. She's very depressed. And her decision is, instead of going, well, they killed my husband. I guess it's done. She goes, all right.
I was second master.
I guess you asked for it.
Now I am master.
Right? So she goes back to the White Lotus and they all say, all right, you're in charge.
Yes.
She gets elected. They choose to have her. And she goes on the attack. She starts attacking the imperial troops using guerrilla warfare. Now, this is guerrilla warfare in the late 1700s. And when we think of guerrilla warfare, it's a lot of like the Spanish-American War. You think of Native Americans. Guerrilla warfare during this time is very unknown. The imperial army had no idea how to fight them.
That's also essentially how we turn the tide of the Revolutionary War.
Yeah.
So at this time it was unknown, but it's interesting the parallels of that.
Oh, absolutely.
Because rather than being a very honorable, like, here we are for Rome and you are on that right. side, we are on this side and we will charge at each other until you all die.
Right.
It's very much like, I'm going to go hide in this tree right. and when these soldiers walk by, I'm just going to shoot them.
And that's absolutely what they did. So they would wait for expeditionary forces to go out and they'd ambush them. They came up with this plan where they would ambush the imperial troops by shooting a volley of arrows that would go above their heads, and as they raised their shields to protect themselves, she would have a second volley of archers, like this, a couple seconds after they shot the one like that, to shoot into the ranks.
That is so, that they would go right in. Smart.
Right? So they would do that. She had spies and used her information incredibly effectively. She would send envoys and messages to villages that they passed on their way around, encouraging them to have uprisings of their own so that imperial forces would have to be dispatched to those towns and she could spread the force that was fighting her directly thin. She could make their numbers less. And then she would also attack the ones that were going to stop the...
Of course.
She also would fight during these skirmishes. She fought on horseback, handless, only using her legs and her feet to give commands to these horses, wielding double swords and kung fuing from the back of this horse too, right? It's said that the sight of her galloping across the field wielding these two swords was enough to send the enemy fleeing. It would send imperial troops, either they would flee or they would switch to her side.
This is another thing in which I want this to be a movie, but I'm already thinking similar to who would sing for Ima Sumac. What stunt person in the world is going to be like, yeah, I'll ride totally with just no hands at all, galloping
on
a horse?
Well, actually, they have a horse that they've bred for centuries in China. And you can actually learn about them in this Warrior Woman documentary, where the horses are very intelligent. They're incredibly intelligent. And not only can they take commands, to this day, they can take commands with just like the leg movements, legs and feet, but they also fight. So they'll use their teeth and their hooves to go after enemies as well.
So we have to finally cast an actual Chinese person to play a Chinese person. That's what we're saying? Okay, great.
Yeah.
I'm on board with that.
There are families who have bred these horses for centuries. That's all they've done. Like, these are families who have just raised horses for centuries.
You're just making me
want
to go to China.
There you go. If there's anything I've done in this about making you want to go to one of my favorite places in the world is that...
China's one of your favorite places?
Yeah, I'm obsessed with Chinese and Japanese culture, Asian culture.
Honestly, until this morning, I have had no desire to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's why I love Chinese food. I love Asian food in general. When I was losing weight throughout college, every Friday I'd have Chinese food Friday.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Yeah, and that's why.
I mean, remember you just being like, it's Chinese food Friday. It doesn't matter.
Now it's Chinese food Thursdays because Warner Brothers, in their cafeteria, they do Chinese food.
Oh, there you go.
On Thursdays.
This is so random, but
no,
I took this test one time, and it wasn't just like a BuzzFeed quiz, like, what country should you live in? It was like, this is legit. All these serious questions. And it said, what city in the world should you really live in based on your personality? And I got Tokyo. And I was like, I really don't see it. That holds no appeal to me at all.
Maybe not Tokyo, but Japan I could see you living in.
Yeah, maybe.
Because it's a quiet, peaceful,
that's what it is.
Happy,
they're like, this is like a city where everyone is introverted, so you'll fit right in. No one would talk to you in an elevator in Tokyo.
And at the same time, they're very community-based and they all love each other. And yeah.
Anyway, go on.
So there's one great example of her tactical skills. She is in Shenyang, and they capture this county called Zhongxing, and the imperial forces surround her. So she's surrounded on all four sides.
Yeah.
Her 20,000 troops are surrounded by like 100 to 150,000 troops.
Yikes.
Right? So she's completely enclosed. What she does is she takes one of her squadrons and she sends them to attack one of the flanks. And thinking that they were under attack, the imperial forces mustered and moved around to meet the attack.
Oh, no.
And in the meantime, Wang took the rest of her troops and went and escaped out where all the rest of the troops had left. So she distracted them. They all moved around.
She's just an incredible battle statistician.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tactical planner.
That's proved by the fact 16 months after this rebellion starts, they end up meeting up with eight other White Lotus sects creating a force of more than 100,000 peasants, women, and paupers. And they elect her the supreme commander.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. All the things.
Unfortunately.
Oh, no.
This is the moment where it all goes bad. It all goes wrong. I know. I'm sorry.
Okay.
They couldn't agree on a strategy.
Just listen to her.
When they all got together, the documentary said that it's possible that they were a little jealous of her notoriety and her fame and her position. Mm. And so they didn't want to listen to her just because, like, well, you know, F you. We're not going to listen to you just because you're whatever, like, to show it to her.
Yeah.
And then they also didn't have her experience. So at the same time that they were like, well, we don't want to do that, they didn't know that her tactics could work as well as they did. They didn't know if they were just stories or if they were actually working. So they didn't want to put their people, right?
All right.
So Wayne goes, okay, I'm not going to deal with this. She takes her 20,000 and she marches on the imperial troops herself. And now she's taking a force of 20,000 to it's hubris. Her hubris gets the better of her. Yeah, so she takes her troops and they're ambushed. The imperial spies had given away their location. And her troops are ambushed at High Shoot Galley in Hubei province. And it's essentially a valley, two high places, like two high mountains on either side. Archers, thousands of them died. Thousands of her forces died.
These spies are really not good.
No.
I guess it depends what side you're on. They clearly did their jobs well.
Right. Absolutely. So thousands of her troops die. She's surrounded by imperial troops on all sides. And rather than being taken alive, she and her co-commander leapt to their deaths from Mao Hill. She was 21.
That sound you hear is my jaw scraping across the floor.
Your jaw did just literally drop. She was 21 years old.
Holy goodness.
And she is known to this day as having led the first successful revolt against the Qing dynasty. Which, if she hadn't have done that, many historians believe that the rebellions that followed, which built on her success, up to and including Mao Zedong's People Revolution,
right,
might not have happened because the people wouldn't have known that their god could bleed.
Mm. I also just think it's incredible that she leapt to her death rather than just stabbing herself.
Yeah. We'd like to take a moment to talk to you about our partners at audible.com.
You can start your free trial and get a free audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery. I am in the middle of the most amazing book right now. Mm-hmm. It's become my Bible. It's called All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women in the Making of an Independent Nation by Rebecca Traister.
Mm-hmm.
I read an excerpt from it on Vogue, maybe, or some website a few months ago, and then I just saw it in the library and was like, oh yeah, I want to read that whole book. It will blow your mind.
Okay.
Essentially, every social reform, labor reform, we owe to young single women. You do need to read it.
Maybe I'll download it.
You should download it.
From audibletrial.com/bitchery. Hey y'all, if you're enjoying the podcast, Allison and I would really appreciate it if you would go to iTunes, Google Play Music, Podomatic, wherever you're listening to the podcast, and give us a rating or a review. Those ratings and reviews help other people find the podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. Thanks. All right, so today in Herstory, on October 5th, 1789, the women of Paris marched on Versailles during the French Revolution to confront Louis XVI about feudalism, demand bread, and have the king and his court moved to Paris.
Go chicks.
Exactly.
On October 7th, 1391, Bridget of Sweden is canonized by Pope Boniface IX. She is one of the patron saints of Europe.
Oh, fantastic. I didn't know that.
We need to look her,
absolutely,
her story.
Yep.
I don't know it.
And then on October 8th, 1645, Jeannie Mance opened the Hôtel Dieu de Montréal, the first hospital in Montreal, Quebec.
Nice.
Wow, fantastic.
Go, ladies.
Absolutely. So what are we talking about this week, Allison?
This week, I thought we could talk about something that I just came across this morning, which is the history of women shaving.
Okay.
And why women in a lot of Western countries and most countries in the world at this point shave their legs and their armpits and maybe other parts as well, depending on your preferences.
What'd you find out?
It really was down to advertising. There's two stories. The one that I came upon the most, so it seems slightly more accurate, is that in the 1920s, Harper's created and started selling a sleeveless dress for women, so then your armpits would be exposed, and they never had been before, so it was like nobody's going to see it, so what does it matter?
And neither had legs, and, then that's fair.
Right, so their advertisement basically said, hey ladies, you can wear this dress, but any objectionable hair should be removed.
Ah, okay.
To be respectful. That, so yeah, it's really a marketing thing. And legs didn't really start until like the 40s because hemlines were short in the 20s, but nobody really thought about it. And then they got longer again in the 30s. So it's not until the 40s when they got shorter again that then objectionable hair came to also include your legs. There's a lot of people now that are kind of rebelling against this, not necessarily as like a political or a feminist statement of like, hey, men, I'm not going to shave my armpits or my legs.
Right.
Just because if you think about it logically, your body is growing hair there for a reason.
Absolutely. It's for protection.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's probably healthier to just leave it alone.
Yeah. Plus, shaving has side effects.
Listen, one time I cut myself shaving really badly in the dorm room shower at UNCG. I wasn't friends with anyone on my hall. No. Not even really my roommate. Like, we got along. Right, we were fine, but we were not close. So I was standing in the shower. I mean, I took off a good, like, inch of my skin. Oh, I was standing in the shower, blood pouring down the drain, and I'm just thinking to myself, crap, why am I not friends with anyone on my hall? I can't yell out to anyone, like, I'm bleeding out in the shower. So I had to like get out of the shower, hobble over to the bathroom stall, get some toilet paper. My parents were coming to visit, thank goodness, later that day or maybe the next day to come see a play that I was in.
Right.
So I remember texting my mom going, remember those giant Neosporin Band-Aids we have in the bathroom closet at home? Can you bring those to me? Can you bring me the whole box?
Right.
Because I've skinned myself. I've sliced off my skin. I have no more skin on my ankle. So there are major side effects to shaving.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's really all that it is. It was just this advertisement. The other thing that I read is that it was a razor company decided they weren't making enough money because they could only sell to men and women don't have beards.
Right.
So where else could women shave?
I love that you found just one more example of something that is accepted, quote unquote, in society as being, well, this is what's right. This is what you should do. This is what women should do. And really it's like, okay, well, we go all the way back. Where did it start?
And we don't really go all the way back. Oh, we go back only about 100 years.
Someone wanted money.
Yep.
Someone wanted money
and advertisers are making women feel crappy about their bodies. Hashtag life.
Right. So you know what? Shave if you want to. Don't shave if you don't.
Baller.
If you'd like to keep in contact with us, you can do so on our website at umpboh.com.
You can also find us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/umpboh. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at those very same handles.
If you would like to, or if you're able to, support us at patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. Those donations really help in advertising and helping to create more great content for the podcast. That's patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
The Bitchery of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions with myself, Allison.
And myself, Max. And also our co-producer, Chris McNeil.
And as always,
Bitches get stuff done.